women of whalers and women of sailors.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Hey everyone, and happy 2021. You're tuned into Pirate Block Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM, kickstarting the new year. For those of you who are not yet familiar with the show, Pirate Block Radio is coming out of Jijage, also known as Montreal, located on unceded indigenous lands. A show covering topics and discussions together with creators and artists of digital and new media art, led by me, your host, Malte Leander. We are starting this year in a bit of a slow pace, taking time to reflect and look back as one should, during a time of change from one year to the other, by jumping back in the archives. So we are listening to some episodes from previous seasons today. And what better way to do so than to go all the way back to the beginning, to the very first episode of Pirate Block Radio, together with the original hosts, Eliane Elbogen and Martin Rodriguez, as well as an interview with Alejo Tuque and his project Radio Libre, an inspiration behind the initiative of this radio show. Let's get into it.
In here.
All right, guys. Well, this is our first transmission here of Pirate Block Radio. I hope you're all tuned in and listening. This is going to be a monthly show. Every first Thursday of the month, we'll be here with you from 8 to 9, talking about a lot of different topics, but focused around technology, science, and art. We are an artist-run organization called Eastern Block, and this is our radio show.
So, Eastern Block, some of you who know us and those of you who don't, Eastern Block was started in 2007. I'm one of the founding members. Martin's been with us for almost a year now. And we're a digital art center, an artist-run digital art center. We have a program of exhibits, workshops. We organize an annual festival called Sight and Sound. We host artists in residence. And we also have a lab space, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on in the show. And the point of this show is to talk about digital art in Montreal, but also internationally, and talk about topics that are important not only for the art community, but for society with regards to new technology, with regards to digital culture.
So, Eliane, just a quick question for you, because as you said, I've only been with you guys for a little while, and I've always been wanting to ask you. So, Eastern Bloc's been around for 7 years, correct?
Yeah.
So, when did you start it, and why did you start it?
So it was started by myself and two other people. At the time, we were living together, and I guess we had this utopic dream of having a space, an art space, to do cool things in. And we landed on this fabulous space where we are now, on Clark Street, just north of Jean Talon. And just sort of by chance, we managed to secure the space. It was a huge, empty factory. It used to be a textile factory. And little by little, over the years, we built walls, we cleaned it up, we painted, you know, did all of the renovations, and transformed it into the space that it is now. It happened organically. Like, at first, we didn't have this idea that we were going to found a digital art center, you know, professional, fancy digital art center, but it really did evolve over the years into that.
Excellent, excellent, yeah. Well, it definitely is that now, and I feel that we have a growing community.
Is it fancy?
You know, it's exactly as you described it, I think. It's very accurate. So speaking of it, it's gotten bigger. We have a guest with us here who inspired the radio show. Well, he's not here with us, but he's in Switzerland with us live. Alejo, I'm bringing you in. Can you hear us?
Yes, good night or good morning.
Yes, excellent. So Alejo is an artist from Switzerland. I'm going to read you a little bio that I have from him. Alejo Duque is the instigator of participatory arts that aim to build cultural agitation across networks. A member of the P-Node project, he runs with his colleagues at Radio Libre and works on the edition of his dissertation, The Ill-Natured. Radio transverses his interests, satellite spotting, micro FM, streaming, and RC gliders. So that's just a little tidbit about Alejo, but he's definitely the person who inspired us to start this whole pirate radio station. He was kind of doing like a virtual residence during Sight and Sound, our festival that we have every year. And so during this this workshop that he had, he kind of taught us how to make our own micro FM station. So Alejo, I wanted to start off with a couple questions that I have for you here. Your radio, Radio Libre, inspired Eastern Bloc to start our own micro FM station during your virtual residency. So why did you start Radio Libre, and has it become what you hoped it would be?
First of all, good morning, everyone. Hello, Eliane. It's nice to
hear you. Hi, Alejo.
Hey, listen, Radio Libre is a streaming radio platform, and I consider it as a distress frequency. This is something you could find on Wikipedia, and it's a really nice use of radio. They call this frequency a distress frec because you can use it in case of an emergency. So for me, Radio Libre at the beginning was kind of like, let's set up this infrastructure, and we have it there, and we start to feed it with radio programs every now and then. Radio Libre doesn't have a permanent scheduled, perfectly addressable schedule. You know, we play whenever we can. The rule is that whoever plays live can overtake the archives, so everyone who can connect to the streaming server from a mobile device will have priority to go on live. So sometimes we have these very nice sporadic radio shows from parks, and actually the idea is to cover things that are happening in Colombia and South America. But obviously, yes, we program some archives, and sometimes we do shows live from parties and stuff like that. So it's very open, it's very flexible. It's an experiment with friends. So so far, it's been there for 2 years. I mean, there's no sponsoring, and it's a really nice kind of open experimentation.
Right, that's great. Yeah, and I was reading on your website or somewhere that you was really started to empower people to give them the voice and some of, you know, these things, the voice of the unheard. And, I think that that's kind of what inspired us to start Eastern Bloc and to kind of speak about the Pirate Bloc Radio and to speak about some of the things that we hold dear. So, because in your art, you also focus a lot with radio and satellites, as mentioned before. So, I was just curious, what is it that drew you to radio in the first place?
Yeah, Martin, this is a very interesting question, because I always try to understand that, and I find myself surprised by the possible answers, because radio is everywhere. You know, radio is on or mobile devices, on all kinds of frequencies. For me, radio is not just the FM signal of an old analog tuner. Not only, you know, I listen to radio in the car while I drive, but for me, radio is also the way I control my gliders. We use these remote controls that are based on the 2.4 gigahertz. So we have transmissions for our GSM telephones on other bands, and satellites are sending all this data, and we're trespassed by these waves all the time, you know. So radio is everywhere, and And I don't know, you know, when you think in radio, just in terms of a radio program or a radio show, then we're kind of limited, but we have all these wireless connections all the time. So for me as an artist, it's fundamental that we can go back and try to work with these waves. And one of those spaces that is also offering us like a political kind of outreach is the micro FM level, because it allows us to share with a little group or a bigger group some content and experiment. Well, at the same time, we are still in the legal kind of space of the use of radio waves. We are not transmitting with a lot of power, and we're actually addressing the micro level and the way that networks can be built from little cells somehow. So it's a very broad question. I don't have a clear answer, but I think it's around all of this, what I just said.
But it's interesting when you say that radio is everywhere. For you, because, you know, we're in this fast-paced digital society or post-digital society, some might even say. So for you, how do you see the role that radio plays in our contemporary society? Like when we invited you last year for Sight and Sound, there's this fascination with radio as what some might see as an obsolete technology, but in reality it's not. Like you say, it's everywhere. We're surrounded by radio waves. So where do you think this maybe, is it a renewed fascination? Is there is there something that is drawing people today in the 21st century back to radio?
Hey, it's a very nice question. And the first thing that comes to mind is something we talk about, and for me, it was like a very big privilege to be kind of invited to Canada, that has like a really big tradition on radio and on radio art specifically. So we have this privilege of being artists, to know that we can explore things in a very free way, like no one else can somehow. So for us, you know, let's say there's a very big chance that we have in our hands the redefinition of what radio is today. And some of the things we've been doing, and I say we because it's not just me, you know, it's you, it's Martin, and the feedback that we create with each other, that this kind of synergy that starts to build up what brings in network streams, right now Skype chat, that is going to be aired on the FM waves. So this is kind of the materialization of these waves and these wavelengths and these many, many intentions and many, many nice intentions, actually, that we are canalizing somehow. So we have the experiment of using these mobile devices and at the same time passing a feed through the internet, but also bringing it down to even light, to transform the radio transmission into light and send it from one source to another source and see what happens, and then explore the sound that is generated, you know, the signal to noise ratio that appears, and of course the encrypted kind of level of disturbances that appear are all source material for sound art and for our experimentation. So I don't know if the post-digital question is answered. I don't think so, but I will say that we have in our hands this big diversity of resources and of people coming together across the planet, and that's a really nice moment for us. It and see, maybe someone else later on will define something out of it, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I remember one thing from your workshop that we did. You were talking about light and transmissions and satellites, and I remember that we were able to bring up like a live weather feed based off of a satellite that we were able to connect to, and that was, for me, that was like the first time I'd done that. I know that's something that you practice a lot with, but it was very impressive.
Yes, this is exactly one of the ways that we can get kind of conscious about what's going on around us, and yes, definitely in times that the technology is kind of overwhelming, you know, that we have actually we're surrounded by all these black boxes, When you manage to interpret, to understand one of them, there's this kind of aha moment that helps you to open maybe other boxes, and it's something like to see, especially when technology breaks. I'm pretty much interested on trying to find the moment when the machine is not operating, because this is the moment when we are kind of not over them, but like in control. We become again the real user, not the ones who are being used by technologies. And to that extent, I find myself more and more in the position of the Luddite. I don't know how's the pronunciation.
Luddite.
Yes, merci. Thank you. So I find myself in that space more and more, because I think this is the way that we can sort of liberate, in quotation, somehow from this tyranny of the machines. And this is really strong, and it's going to become more and more strong with all these algorithms deciding and profiling. And we are being traced all the time. So it's really to find the breakthroughs from this kind of naivety or rebel or resistance kind of act of the breakage when something doesn't operate. I like to go to that space more. So when we fly planes, for example, in a last project called Drone Tone with Cyril Henry, and the plane crashes, We're having these kind of good moments of aha, this is really working, because we are able to bring it down, and maybe we manage to fix it during the time of the performance and fly again the plane and produce more sounds with it. But if we crash, is for me kind of a welcome moment, and is a moment of reflection.
Definitely.
I don't know if I make sense. I hope so.
I think so. What I wanted to do now is play a little excerpt of your work so that the listeners can get an example of some of the work that you've done. This no-go for you, do you want to introduce it somehow, or should I just play something?
Oh, yeah, I can. It's a sound piece, 59 minutes. It uses as a backdrop a very varied collection of transmissions, most of them from satellites. Many of them are archive sounds. Some of those are satellites that don't operate anymore. So we have all these chirps and weird electronic sounds of transmissions. Of course, over them we have other recordings, like from the space shuttle to the weather satellites, to typical voice communication on the clear. And and it was done with a friend, Sam, we are. We're sharing it now in Quito in an exhibition called Arte en Órbita. That I find very interesting, this exhibition, because it's about it's in Ecuador, in the latitude zero where the geostationary satellites are projected. I mean, the geostationary objects are 36,000 kilometers above, and they appear static to us in the planet. But they are there in the latitude zero because they can cover more population areas. So they don't place a satellite over the poles because they won't cover too many countries. But latitude zero, that is in the tropics, is kind of a natural resource overtook by the powerful countries of the planet who have the technology. So latitude zero is full of satellites. It looks like Saturn, you know, like we have a ring. And we are in the center of this medial ring. The planet Earth has a ring, an artificial ring, that is geostationary satellites. So this piece is dedicated to all those who don't afford and cannot afford to have such a technology up there. So this is why it's called No Go for You. And I'm sorry, it was a long introduction, but I hope makes sense for the piece. Yes,
definitely. I started fading it in at the end there, but it wasn't to pull you off the stage. It was to put some context behind your voice.
Ah, it's perfect.
Okay, here we come.
after having listened to an excerpt of this very first episode of Pirate Block Radio, we are now transitioning into listening to a talk that took place in the context of the Sight and Sound Festival of 2015. A discussion with Alain Thibault, the artistic director of digital art festival Electra.
So we have here now Alain Thibault, who is the artistic director of the Bienne, Bias, and Electra. He's also an electronic music artist and sound designer. Hello. Salut, Alain.
Hello, hello.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So, yeah, so this year was the first edition of the Bias, Biennale Internationale d'Art Sonore. And we're curious, where did the impetus for creating this event or this biennial come from?
The idea came from the fact that sound art was really, how can I say, emerging, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I think from the past, and it was became very important into the media arts, digital arts, community festivals, etc. So I thought that would be good to, you know, because we had this second edition of Digital Arts Biennale, and so between the Digital Arts Biennale, it would be good to installation components during Electra to really label it, and I thought it would be good to really put a focus on some art. So that was the idea. So on the not the even year it's the Digital Arts Biennale, but on the Les années impaires, sorry.
The odd year.
Odd year, yeah. Would be the fun art biennale.
Okay. And so do you see that there's really enough material to cover in each alternating year then, for one being more dedicated to sound art and one generally dedicated to digital art?
Absolutely. Okay, the only thing missing is the money.
I think that's always the only thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this year you had a really interesting theme, which was post audio, which I really enjoyed, and it reflects on the issues of the place of audio in a post digital era. This is like a super interesting topic, and I was wondering, as a composer and sound designer, how your personal relationship with audio changed over the past decade.
I'm always, how can I say, I think for all the last years, we always, maybe everybody felt that maybe the visual was much more, had much more power over the sound. But in fact, you know, especially in a big hall venue, all this, you really can feel that audio is much more stronger than the visuals. It can make a much more emotional impact on you. So you know that's why we have chosen, you know, the theme was post audio goes with all that things that post digital, the coming back, how can I say, the comeback of the analog and all this, and it wasn't the idea was to really put in front, you know, the fact that audio was in fact, much more powerful than visuals.
Yeah, well, it can definitely grab you pull on strings emotionally that visuals can't. And you know, I think for me, music and sound, it's always dealing with things that we can put into words, and we try to put images to, but it speaks to like a human condition that's very at the core.
Yes, it's music or sound is the most abstract art, I would say.
I would agree. So, you know, speaking about post-digital and all these sort of things, the recently technology has just shot, you know, everything, especially audio, through the roof. You can, you know, produce large, you know, professional works from your home studio, from a laptop. Mm-hmm. You can bring like a whole orchestra with your laptop and, you know, a modular synth and a whole vinyl collection. So how do you think this has impacted the consumption and the creation of art?
But we can see that, especially with the advent of internet, etc., and it's much more easier to create music now. And so you can see that the value of music also went down very much, you know, with the internet, MP3, all this. So what's very interesting is that you can create very interesting music with a much lower budget, if you want. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the value of music and sound went so low that I think it's going to also to be a problem with visuals. So I think that's the impact of digital technology, internet over... on culture, if you want.
So in a way, the accessibility or the democratization of technology is influencing sound.
The value of what it is, yes. So it's at the same time we can enjoy it at a much lower cost, but at the same time the artist creating this has no problem to survive. So it's a funny, it's an interesting situation.
Do you think maybe that's where the renewed interest in analog is coming from?
I think it's coming from this post-digital. We're in a post-digital era, so it was normal, I think, that analog synthesizer, for example, came back. I think it's a mix of there's some romanticism into that, and at the same time, it's the need for artists to be able to have a much more, direct input on sounds, for example.
Yeah, more material approach.
Yeah, totally. So it's a mix of both. You know, myself as a composer, you know, I have a collection of analog synthesizers, all this, but of course at the end, you know, digital technology is much more easier and to use and really accelerate the process of producing music or sound art. So I like to mix both of them. Mm.
Definitely. So do you find like how we consume just media in general, do you find that like with all this information floating around that it's influenced the compositions of artists? Like maybe not directly the sounds, but the compositions that artists are creating?
Absolutely. You know, I could see over the years, you know, how, for example, that type of software, the way it was constructed, the way you had to compose, for example, with it, influenced the way you were doing the music or sound art. So yes, all this has an influence, you know, of course, yes.
Great. So one of the questions that we had for you is because we're collaborating with you, with MSHR, with Electro.
Yes.
And we were curious as to, you know, what was the impetus, I guess, to collaborate with Eastern Bloc on this specific project? You know, why did you think of us?
I think it's the perfect venue. You know, I would say that I saw MSHR at Transmedial in Berlin last year, and when I saw their setup, it was a bit strange. So, but it's very interesting because, you know, I could say it's a post-neo EP performance. and not in a bad way, you know, not in a pejorative way, but it, you know, it has that hippie feel and that meat. But what I like mostly is that mysticism feel of it, of this, that kind of performance. So I think it would be perfect in Eastern Bloc with all the cracking floors and all this. No, no, it would be very, very good. So it would be a great way to, you know, for us, it's a co-production with Eastern Bloc, but for us it's a great way to finish, to end this bias, Biennale Internationale d'Art Sonore. You know bias, why I chose it? You know what is a bias?
Yeah, well, in an amplifier.
Mostly in a tape recorder. You know, it's a very important parameter that really helps to make the sound recorded in a good way, if you want.
Right. Yes.
You know, because the first years I used many tape recorders and had to calibrate them, so that was the idea.
Yeah.
Let's, but also it has a link with Beyond, which is the Biennale Internationale d'Art Numérique.
Speaking of which, so next year I imagine you're already starting to plan the next edition of the Beyond?
Yes, we have the team, so it's Automata, it's art made by machines for machines.
For machines?
Yeah, for machines, for a public of machines.
Okay.
Yes, of course. Because, you know, we have to think about the future, you know.
So can, I can buy a ticket for my iPhone?
A ticket?
Yeah.
For
my iPhone, my robot? My
then your iPhone would be dead. You know, I can tell you, you know, the story. Do we have time?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So the theme is it's based on the idea of do you know what is singularity?
Yes.
So singularity is the moment where the machines will be as intelligent as humans, and when I say machines, it's in its broader sense. And there's a guy, do you know Ray Kurzweil?
Yeah.
Yeah, so of course he's a specialist of artificial intelligence. He's the new director of engineering at Google and all this. And for me, it's very interesting because this guy is a specialist of artificial intelligence. And we know that maybe those machines, entre guillemets, could be the next step. Next step of human evolution, but at the same time, this guy really has a diet, you know, to extend his life as much as possible. So for me, the next Biennale is really about immortality, you know. There's a kind of contradiction between the fact that somebody like that eats, used to eat like 250 pills, now his diet is 150 pills per day to extend his life, but at the same time he's working on technology that could be our next the next step of evolution. So the idea is to you know, it's a fun idea, I think, to try to anticipate, to see what machines could create as art. Will they be able of aesthetic, and maybe their public would be machines as well? So
that's a very interesting question. And
what will be the place of the of humans into that also? So
right,
an interesting scenario.
Right, excellent. Well, that sounds like a great theme. And I think we've had a great conversation, so it's a good place to transition into our next guest, Nicolas Dion, who is coming. We're going to play a little piece from Rie, talking about acoustics and kind of more of a human performance, the return of the human, the post-audio. So we'll play a little bit of this, and then we'll get back with our interview. Okay. So thank you very much, Alain.
It was a pleasure.
Merci.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Pirate Block Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM. And for this first episode of the year, we are walking down memory lane, listening to excerpts of older episodes throughout the years. We are now taking a few steps forward in time with talks happening around the Acousma Festival back in 2017, tuning into interviews with composers Elizabeth Anderson, followed by a talk with Adam Besanta, both carried out by the previous host of Pirate Block Radio, Tatum Wilson.
Welcome to Pirate Block Radio, Elizabeth. Welcome to Montreal. Do you want to start by giving us a little bit of a background on yourself and acousmatic art and music?
Sure, Tatum. First of all, thanks for inviting me to give an interview. A background in acousmatic music. Well, my background is sort of the long road, if you will. I studied instrumental music, and I have a background in classical piano in the States, and I completed a master's degree in composition, also instrumental and vocal composition using contemporary techniques. And at the end of that, I decided I'd like to do a proverbial year in Europe, which is sort of a dream, a big dream of a lot of musicians. But a year in Europe, about 30 years ago, turned into a much longer affair because I realized I wanted to learn the language and finish a proper diploma. So I got accepted into the program in instrumental composition at the Brussels Conservatory, and I thought, well, I'll do a year, but in order to do a proper degree, I had to do 3 years. And that's where I got snagged, because the type of compositional techniques in Europe were much more avant-garde. And that was great. And I found myself trying to make timbres in my instrumental compositions that did not exist, and that was a signal for me to branch out and to make them electronically. So there was no electroacoustic degree at all in Belgium at that point. There was only electronics. And I did a degree at the Antwerp Conservatory in electronic composition, which was very much in the culture of Stockhausen. So I had to learn how to program and work completely with electronics. And I did that, finished that degree, and combined it with a degree. At that point, there was a degree that opened in the southern part of the country, because I'd done this in Antwerp. And then in the Mons Conservatory in the southern part of Belgium, which is French-speaking, I did a degree in electroacoustic composition. And then I thought, well, I'd like to finish this with a doctorate. And I did my doctorate in London at City University and with Dennis Smalley. And that's where I really feel that I grew as a composer and branched out and really got my research underway and my compositional style. So I had been specializing in electroacoustics for about 25 years, and the last 16 of that in multiphonic acousmatic work.
Do you see your environment, example, living in Belgium, affecting your work compositionally?
Yes. I'm very attuned to form and structure, and I try to make my tools work for me, and I'm not after the latest, snazziest type of compositional tool, just for the sake of it. I'm not saying that folks in other places work that way, but the quality of the art was the most important thing. And I find that in Europe in general, people are very attuned to excellence, and that I really enjoyed that. So I do find that for each of my compositions, I try to make them as good as possible. Anything less than perfect won't float. So, yeah.
So you recently had a piece of yours performed at Acousma. Do you want to talk a bit about that and what went into the making of it?
Sure. I actually had two pieces performed last night. One is Solar Winds, which is a multiphonic acousmatic piece. Solar Winds is about 5 years old. It's octophonic in nature, and I premiered it in Mexico in 2012, and it was actually composed for a festival in Mexico because I wanted to honor the Maya culture at around the time when the long-term calendar was changing from one type of calendar to another, and that happened in December 21st, 2012. I think everybody knows about that. I thought, well, how do I honor the Mayan civilization at that time? And I realized after some research that their astronomers were quite fabulous. They were able to pick out bodies of planets and stars with the naked eye, and they were able to tell where they were in the calendar year, what day they were, and that's absolutely incredible, that kind of training. So I thought I'd like to celebrate the Mayan astronomers. How? Well, I came upon an astrophysic theory by a British astrophysicist, James Dungy, and it in which the solar winds coming from the sun interact and reconnect with the Earth's magnetosphere. And it's a beautiful visual diagram. And the great thing about that is it's completely silent. It's happening around us all the time, this solar winds that come from the sun and the magnetic reconnections. So my goal was to sonorize that and to build a piece based on, I would rather say inspired by, this theory by James Dungy. It is not a replication of the model by far. I really abstracted from it, but it was the thing that inspired me. So Solar Winds, the active acousmatic piece, is inspired by that theory, and it's a journey in which the listener is Earth and has the solar winds streaming around him or her. And for this piece, I used acoustic transcriptions of electromagnetic recordings by NASA, and they were horrific in quality. They were absolutely the worst. I got them off of the internet, and it took an enormous amount of work to make something out of them, but they're in there, they're in the piece. And I thought, that's great, because I didn't want to use models, I wanted to use the real thing. The question was, can I get the real thing to be of a high enough quality? And finally, it worked. So that was one of the pieces. And the other piece is called L'Heure Bleue, Renaître du Silence. So the blue hour, becoming reborn from silence. And that is all about waking up. And you might think, well, what does that have to do with acousmatic music? Well, it's the awakening of, the piece starts with the awakening of different parts of human life, the human body, and then civilization, and then nature in a larval stage, and then a full-blown stage of nature, and then finally the psychological awakening of man and the spiritual awakening. So it's, why did I choose such a title and such a piece? Because when I was composing Solar Winds and its companion piece And Beyond, I had to work in the studio at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was the only free time. And I composed these pieces at the Musique de Cherche studio in Belgium, about 30 miles south of Brussels. L'Heure Bleue, Renaître du Silence, is a commission from GRM, from the Groupe de Recherche Musicale in Paris. So that was great. I had 3 weeks of work in Paris, but it took longer than 3 weeks to compose a multiphonic acousmatic piece. So the rest of the time I was at Musique de Cherche. But anyway, that whole piece was inspired by the studio slot of the previous two pieces, which was 4 a.m. People think that 4 a.m. is ridiculous as a time to compose, and I hated it at first, but then I began to love it because it was prime time for the ear. The ear is not tired out, and so you can imagine anything you want. And so the second piece of last night's performance is inspired by the time of day in which I had to compose it as well. So my studio slots were 4 a.m. So yeah, those are the two pieces I presented.
So when you go about composing these pieces, are you highly conceptualized before, or do you kind of collect materials as you go along? How do you go about sonorizing it?
Okay, there is a combination, a dialectic that I use between a concept. I'm a very conceptual person, so I always start with some sort of concept. But then there is the sound material that I gather that sometimes I gather just for the sake of gathering it. If I'm in a time and place where I find there's a wonderful sound, I will record it. And it might or might not serve the material for the piece. But those sounds that I record, I treat them with a lot of reverence. I take an enormous amount of time to record and to treat my sounds, treat them, in other words, clean them up, and to process them, to transform them. And they also have a word in the composition. So the dialectic runs between the overriding concept that I'd like to introduce to in the piece and the sounds that decide themselves how they want to be put together. And so sometimes in a piece, it's the concept that sort of takes precedence, sometimes the sounds themselves. And the trick is to know when and what's the most important thing to do where in a piece at any one time. So,
are there any recent trends sonically or aesthetically you have noticed as of the last few years?
I think the last few years have been much more, I don't want to say inspired by technology, but they've been much more dependent on technology. And the danger of that is that composers can start to sound like each other because certain softwares and certain transformational techniques, certain spatialization techniques, I don't want to say they sound alike, but they lead a composer to think in a certain manner. And even the layout on a computer screen can affect how you think. So I think that we're very much more technologically dependent than we were when we started off in the analog era, where everybody had a very different voice. So I would say there is a tendency for multiphonic, acousmatic work, much more than in the past, of course, because of the technical possibilities we have now. And there is ambisonics is a field that people are getting into, wave field synthesis. Live electronics is blossoming. I noticed that in the festival here, and it's performed in a venue that's very respectful for it, because live electronics often is conducted in bars with a public that's drinking, and you hear the bar in the background and people are sitting on floors, and perhaps it's not the most ideal musical venue. So having this kind of live electronics that I've seen in this festival in a very sophisticated venue is really nice. It lends it a whole another dimension, a whole another clothing, if you will, which was really great. So that's happening more and more. There is a tendency to live electronics, and I know that when I work with the electroacoustic section at the Moules Conservatory, it's mostly acousmatic based. The person that started that section wanted acousmatic music to be more forefront. But the students are getting more and more excited about doing live electronics, to the point where I think they're going to want to have a degree in live electronics. So that's a real push too.
Welcome to the show, Adam. Let's start off with your performance a couple weeks ago at Eastern Bloc. One thing I noticed is how dead silent it was when you're performing. Like, the audience was just very dead set on seeing everything going on. Do you want to talk a bit about what you were doing there and the setup and everything?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm glad the audience was quiet. It's a bit of a trick also if you play quietly, but there is a sense that something is happening that is interesting. I think people respond to that, and it's a really nice way to start a concert, actually, and kind of like allow people to focus their attention, and then you can always get louder from there, but they already start in a very attentive kind of mindset. What I was doing was a live performance using mostly feedback, almost all feedback, controlled feedback sounds. So I have two microphones in my hands, one in each hand, and a bunch of speaker cones on the table, and then I manipulate the feedback by moving my hands, moving the microphones closer to the different speaker cones, and processing it a bit in the computer and spitting it back out through the speaker cones. And I use the idea of the performance is to make 100% physical electronic music. So an electronic music where the physical act is not just pressing a button, It's really integral to every sound that's being made. If you remove the physical action, you can't make the sound. So the control of the volume is dependent on the position of my hands, the microphones in relation to the speakers. I use jars as physical filters for the sound and objects that are used to prepare the speakers. But it's really an acoustic instrument that is then being amplified and sent out to the audience so everybody can hear it.
Is there an improvisational element to it at all?
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of like a structured improvisation. So I have five sections which are kind of clearly defined. If I performed it again, you would recognize that I started in a very similar way. So I kind of have like a set of notes that I can create using feedback. And then from there, it's improvised. So I don't have a written score for like what kind of melody I'm going to play. But I have a set of notes that I can use. And then I just use my melodic sensibility or improvisation to create the actual melody that you will hear, and when to repeat notes and when not to repeat notes. And this is really difficult to do completely written because it's hard to control the feedback. So sometimes a note feeds back faster than I would expect it because of a few centimeters difference in hand position or just the acoustics of the room allowing one note to feed back faster than another. So I have to respond to how that works, and if there's a certain envelope of feedback that's very slow, then I'm going to wait on that note. I'll probably embellish that. Like I'll wait even longer because there's a tension that is there that I didn't decide on it, but I'm responding to it and I'm saying, okay, there's this tension. I'm going to emphasize it even more, kind of thing.
So walk us through a day in the studio with you. What's your day-to-day work?
It changes day-to-day, but I would say first of all, I travel a lot, so when I'm in Montreal, my day-to-day is I wake up and probably like an hour or two of emails, admin kind of stuff at home, and then go to the studio. I usually have 2-3 ongoing projects that I'm developing, so that I might work on one or several of them over a few hours. That could be anything from ordering materials or just letting some sort of process run and seeing what I think about it and trying different variations on it, to just, you know, mundane fabrication stuff. Things need to be soldered, things need to be assembled. And then there is also the kind of projects that are completed but need to be shipped, or I need to find out how much it costs to ship in one way to somebody in Europe and where does it go next from there. And so there's a lot of these kind of logistical elements. But ideally there's at least a few hours of work of just trying things and making mistakes and seeing if they are interesting mistakes.
So speaking of Europe, you were in Portugal recently for an exhibition. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it was part of a festival called Semibreve, which takes place in Braga. It's a city in Portugal in the north. It's a music festival, electronic music festival, and they had a few installations this year, of which one of them, the installation that I made in collaboration with Gil Delindro, who's a Portuguese artist, a friend of mine who's based in Berlin, it won an award, so that we had some extra funding for the production of it. Award. And basically it's 25 pieces of frozen earth that are suspended from a grid, and then they slowly decompose as they melt. They're kind of permafrosted, and as they fall, the pieces fall onto a platform which has contact mics on it, so it amplifies the impacts. At the same time, there's 8 speaker cones that are on the platform that are creating low-frequency oscillation patterns. So they're not making sound, just driving the speakers super hard with very, very inaudible oscillations. So we're just moving the cone back and forth. But because these speakers are on a platform, they kind of hit the platform like acoustic instruments, and they activate the platform as well. And when pieces of earth fall onto the speakers are moving and they're shaking the earth, so it becomes like again, like an acoustic instrument, a physical shaker. And so it's kind of a combination of these 3 levels. And basically every day we put, or every 6 hours, we put 25 pieces of frozen earth and we just let them decompose. And then we put another 25. And by the end, it's just a layer of earth on the platforms.
When you start making an installation or a piece, how much thought do you give to the visual element before thinking about the sound part of it?
A lot. I mean, it really depends. There are projects that come out of a sonic idea and projects that come out of a visual idea, and then you work to connect the other side. But it's always super, super important for me. I mean, this is like, you know, the visual impact is the first point of contact between the audience and the piece. The sound comes later. Like, first you see it kind of instantaneously, and I'm very interested in creating an impact with that first impression that will then make them want to stay and listen to the sound, because depending on the audience, these are people who are expecting visual art in a gallery, and you need to grab them in a way that's visual first. But also, I try to not think of the works as having a sounding dimension and having a visual dimension and having a conceptual dimension. Of course, you can analyze each part of it, but the idea is to create something that's very integrated, and that the visual is an important part of creating the sound, or the sound is an important part of how the visual is constructed, and they both relate to a concept in a way that it's very hard to separate them like you would an audiovisual performance, where you create the sound, then you create visuals for it. There we have like two media that are combining together, and I'm interested in creating something that's very hard to separate the three elements from it.
What are some elements you would like to explore in the future with your work?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of things I'm working on right now. I guess one thing that's a bit different is there are two new pieces I'm working on that don't involve sound as heavily as other works. So I'm interested in how sound is used, but maybe not as a primary element in some works, and whether or not I'm able to do that in an interesting way. That's one thing. But I'd say in general, I'm just really interested in continuing to develop a very personal language, you know, something that's very outside of kind of established ways of working with these kind of materials. It's a bit vague, but...
Well, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
To wrap this show up, I'm going to play a segment of Adam's performance at Eastern Bloc for Akuzma. Thanks for listening.
This archival episode of Pirate Block Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM with me, your host, Malte Leander. And as of next month, we are back in full effect with new, exciting, and interesting talks, interviews, and sonic experiences for you to enjoy. In the meantime, you can always go on over to our Mixcloud, where you can browse freely all episodes from previous seasons. Just type in Pirate Block Radio. See you soon.
Looking to become bilingual or promote bilingualism in Canada? Look no further. Apply for the Odyssey or Explore program for the chance to improve your French or help young people improve their English. You'll immerse yourself in another region's language and culture, make new friends, and have experiences that will stay with you forever. Many people say the Odyssey and Explore programs have changed their lives. To find out more or to apply, visit englishfrench.ca.
De 26 ans. J'ai une petite soirée assez intéressante pour vous. Premièrement, ça me fait très plaisir d'être ici avec vous. C'est la première fois que je fais une émission en différé. Donc, j'espère que vous apprécierez. C'est un peu différent parce qu'il faut comme monter son émission. Généralement, on la fait, on la joue dans la, dans la soirée, disons. Mais là, cette fois-ci, je l'ai monté sur live. Donc voilà, j'ai concocté un petit mix d'artistes de Modular Synth Québec, donc qui est un groupe d'amateurs de synthétiseurs modulaires, des amis à moi. Et j'ai aussi deux pistes de Michel Desrochers, que vous connaissez sûrement. Je reçois Olivier de Space Cloud Filter qui vient nous parler de son projet de Noël. Donc, voilà. Je commence par une pièce envoyée par François Giroux, qui s'appelle Mimi.